Here's the editor of Lenswork Publishing, Brooks Jensen.
It's often been said that we all think about history as if it started when we were born, and that something that happened long before is ancient history, and we measure life by our own experiences. Maybe that's just part of being a human being. And I hope I haven't developed this idea with a prejudice toward my own lifetime and photographers of my generation to the point where I'm missing something obvious. But nonetheless, here goes. When I started in photography in the 1970s, a great print was a considerable rarity. There weren't a lot of great prints around other than the things that the famous masters of photography had done, but not that I could see, not that were readily available for me to inspect and learn from. They were locked up in museums and private collections, and I knew a couple of people who had some interesting images, important even historically images, and so it's not like I didn't have any opportunities to see good work, but it was very, very rare. And in fact, to produce a really terrific print was considered an accomplishment, a noteworthy accomplishment. One of my favorite pictures about this is from my friend Stu Levy, who attended an Ansel Adams workshop in the early 70s, and he has a picture of Ansel Adams sitting in his home surrounded by workshop students. And Ansel Adams was holding high above his head an 11 by 14 print so everybody in the room can see it. An 11 by 14 print. The first thing is, nobody makes 11 by 14 prints anymore, not for showing, not for major exhibition. But back then, that was an accomplishment. 16 by 20 was, wow, that was jaw-dropping. And all the students in the workshop are sort of leaning forward and taking a careful look at this print because seeing prints of that quality was almost an impossibility. And many, many photographers have told me that essentially they got hooked into photography and they knew they wanted to be a photographer the first time they saw a really high quality print from a photographic master. Maybe as early as the 50s, maybe the 60s, maybe the 70s. They had only seen photography in books that were printed in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, and the printing quality was suspect, and so when they saw an original print and how absolutely gorgeous it was, they knew that photography was something more substantial than they had first thought. They were hooked. They wanted to be able to make those kinds of images for themselves. So some of you probably remember the Fred Picker sample prints. These were little 8x10 prints that he or his assistants would produce on gelatin silver materials in his darkroom, printed to his standards relative to black densities, the so-called D-max densities, and the graduated tones of the grays, and a quality print. You could buy these prints for $25. The idea wasn't that they were collectible or anything. The idea would be that you'd thumbtack them up in your darkroom so that you knew what a decent print was supposed to look like, because whatever you saw in books wasn't that. And so these sample prints became an important guide for all of us to raise the standards of what we were trying to produce in our own darkrooms. When I went to my first serious workshop in the early 1980s, one of the main things that I recall from that workshop were the boxes and boxes and boxes of prints that Bruce Barnbaum and John Sexton and Ray McSavany brought to that workshop for us to see. And it was mind-boggling. I mean, how could one person produce that many absolutely wonderful, great photographs? It incentivized us, all of us who were there. It incentivized us to try to raise our standards so that we could produce a body of work, all of which, every single print of which, would be an example of technical excellence. Well, just as a hint of where I'm going in this topic, compare that to today, when an internet search can bring you literally gazillions of high-quality photographs on your computer monitor, where prints are pretty readily available because you probably know a dozen or two dozen photographers who all have printers and the ability to make really outstanding photographs, thanks to the power of Photoshop and digital processing and the incredible capabilities of inkjet printing, or as far as that goes, maybe still gelatin silver, platinum palladium, gum bichromate printing, etc. And even if the chemistry hasn't changed, the availability of knowledge and how to make something as complex as a platinum palladium print has become more readily available than it was 50 years ago. So that's sort of step one in today's thought about a fire hose of images. Step two is to consider the differences between printing quality and book reproduction over, let's say, the last century or so. 100 years ago in 1925, half-tone printing had only been around for a half a dozen years or so, and it was pretty primitive, and the inks weren't very black, and the dots, those newspaper-quality dots that are used to reproduce black-and-white photographs, were pretty large and visible even to the naked eye. And so when Edward Weston wanted to do My Camera on Point Lobos or California in the West, he employed the best printing possible, but it was a far, far cry from what he was able to produce in the darkroom. And that's what engendered that so common experience of seeing the difference between what was printed in a book and what was available in an original gelatin silver print, and why so many photographers of my generation were so blown away by the quality of original photographs, gelatin silver materials. But today, consider that today. There is so little difference between today's high-quality printing in a book or a poster and an original print that the differences have essentially evaporated. It's not uncommon for photographers we've published in Lenswork to tell me that the reproductions in Lenswork look just as good as their original prints, sometimes even better. And that is a complete reversal from the previous generations like Stieglitz and Weston and Adams and Minor White and Wynne Bullock and etc. Put another way, today's high-quality printing, not only in inkjet prints, but primarily in commercial offset printing like we see in books, is so good that that experience of a great print being a rarity and an accomplishment has literally evaporated. Well, it was made by the photographer, and so it's signed, and it's an original, and it has some emotional connection for us that makes us want to collect original prints. But in terms of what our eyeballs see as printing quality, there's no difference. And going to a gallery and seeing a couple of dozen or maybe 30 or 40 really high-quality prints on the wall, you can pick up a book and see a lot more prints, a fire hose of images, as it were. Which takes me to the experience which is the foundation for this entire podcast episode. And that is that roughly a year or so ago, I had an opportunity to visit a photographer and was looking through a sizable book in his presence. And it was a tremendous moment of pride for this photographer, and I can understand why. It was a big, thick book, 400 pages or something like that, and a lifetime of work, which he was very proud of. And I started flipping through the book and was very impressed. The quality of the images were great. The reproduction in the book was fantastic. It was a large book, so it was reasonably sized. I was really enjoying it. For about the first 50 images or so. And then I have to admit, my attention began to wane a little. But, you know, courtesy, I kept looking, flipping pages, looking at each image. We'd have a short conversation from time to time. I'd flip through some more pages. This went on for quite some time, and as my attention began to wane more and more, I realized my brain was just becoming saturated with a fire hose of images. And after 100 images, I was just numb. I couldn't see anymore. There were just too many. And I said to the photographer, you know, I kind of have to stop looking at these because I'm not giving them the attention that I really should, because I think I'm saturated and I need a break. Let's have a cup of coffee. And so we went off to Starbucks and had a scone and a cup of coffee and went back. And I repeated the experience again, not intentionally, but during the first 50 or 60 images, I was very excited. Picking up from where we'd left off before our coffee break, I was very excited for the first 50 or 60 images, and then I started to get full again. It's like someone pouring coffee into a coffee cup and not stopping when the coffee cup is full. Pretty soon, it's just running out all over the table. Well, that was what was happening to me. I was stuffed. I couldn't eat another bite or view another photograph, as it were, because I was just filled. From that experience, I began to pay more attention to this idea of the volume of images that we consume. Compared, for example, to our grandparents or our great-grandparents, how many images did they see in a typical day in their life, just in the normal course of events, as compared to how many images do we see in the normal course of events, in our average day? It's mind-boggling. That gets compounded by step three in this topic, a fire hose of images, and that is, I went to visit a place called the Clark Museum. It's not far away from where I am here in upstate New York. And they have a library of art books that are available to the public on weekdays. Very generous. It's lovely to be able to go in there. You can't check them out as a member of the public, but you can look and see anything you want to see. And I discovered they have this mind-boggling collection of photography books that is shelves and shelves and shelves, two rooms with multiple sets of shelves that are, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 feet high and 8, 9 feet long, shelves after shelves after shelves of just photography books. That doesn't count all the rest of them in the library. This is a huge building. But I wouldn't be surprised if there were maybe 10,000 photography books, monographs, every kind of book you can imagine, all alphabetized by photographer. So I was interested in looking at Joseph Sudek. So I went over to that section of the shelf under S and found 15 Joseph Sudek books, several of which I've never seen, one of which was very, very collectible, I found out later. It was so good I wanted to buy it. When I looked it up on Abe Books, I realized I couldn't afford it. But all of those shelves, all of those books, literally a fire hose of images. What does this mean for the simple concept of photographic literacy? There's no way anybody could know all of that photography. You might be able to know all of a given photographer, at least all the published work. You might be able to know a certain subsection of the fine art photography world, a certain style, a certain location, a certain country, a certain era. But no one could possibly know all that's available in the world of photography based on just those published books. And of course, as you and I probably know, we produce far more work than ever gets published in a book. So just to pick a number out of my head, I wouldn't be surprised if there's 500 photographs produced for every one that's published in a book. A fire hose of images. What are the implications of a world that has this many photographs and more happening every day, particularly since the invention of the iPhone and the trillions of photographs that are being made every year, most of which are probably not worth spending much time thinking about. They're snapshots, they're not intended to be artwork. But there are photographers who are interested in so-called vernacular photography, in which that kind of photograph is collectible, is important, is publishable, because it represents a slice of culture that's indicative of something. How does all of that then multiply what it means to be photographically literate? Well, it seems to me pretty clear that one of the implications of all of this is that none of us can possibly know everything there is to know about photography. We're only going to know the very small slice of photography that we're interested in. Those of you who have been listening to my podcast for a while know that I very definitely have sort of an area of primary interest. It's West Coast landscape photography and East Coast abstract photography. Those are my two primary areas of interest. And I suspect that parallels what a lot of LensWork subscribers and readers think, too. But that's a tiny portion of what's out there. The whole world of portraiture and street photography and social commentary and sports photography and pet photography and wedding photography. I mean, it goes on and on and on. I know, and I'm passionate about, a very narrow slice of that. And it's useful to remember that from time to time, that my interests are personally driven. They're not universal. So everything I've said so far leads to what I think is the most critical question of this entire train of thought about a fire hose of images. What does this mean for what we produce? Here's a practical example. Some of you know, I know not all of you know, so I'm going to take a moment to explain about my little project called Kokoro. Kokoro is a Japanese word that translates roughly to the heart mind, to get to the heart of the matter, if you will. And for a number of years now, I've produced this little anthology I call Kokoro, which is a free PDF downloadable from my website at brooksjensenarts.com. And it's my playground to be able to produce small projects, sometimes images only, more frequently images and a small amount of text, once in a blue moon, a large amount of text. It's my creative expression, what I want to produce with my photographs that I can spread around the world for free. So that's what it is. Each issue of Kokoro has 4, sometimes 6, but usually 4 projects in it. Each project is independent of the others. That's why it's an anthology. I've produced so far 172 projects in Kokoro that contain just under 3,000 images. Would it be correct for me to characterize this as a fire hose of images? And when I was meeting with this group of photographers in Acadia a couple of weeks ago, I decided I would provide each one of them with a little flash drive that had the complete collection of the Kokoros produced to date so that they wouldn't have to download them and they could take a look at them at their leisure on their computer. And I was glad to do it. But afterwards, when I was driving home, I got to thinking, I just presented each of these people with a 3,000-image burden, which I doubt they'll actually look at, because that's way too many images for any person to absorb. I couldn't absorb the 400 images from the retrospective book that I was talking about earlier. How could I possibly expect the other photographers in Acadia to appreciate, to even look at, the 3,000 images that I presented them on the flash drive? How silly of me in some regards. I mean, maybe if I'm lucky, they'll pick and choose the ones that might be interesting to them. I don't know how you do that. I mean, do you do that by the title? Do you open up each one and just take a quick peek and say, no, I'm not interested in this? I haven't even thought about that. How do I promote that kind of volume of images. There's 18 images per project on average, and I really wish I'd been even more ruthless in my editing process. I'm falling more and more in love with the seeing in sixes idea that we introduced in 2016. Six images is just about right, maybe eight. But I'm not so sure 18 isn't more than most people can absorb with any depth of understanding. And as I said at the beginning of this podcast, my attention began to wane after about 50 images. That's like 2.5 projects of Kokoro. And keep in mind, each issue of Kokoro has 4 to 6 projects. I guess the implication is, what my expectations are, is that people will look at one project at a time and then set it aside and then maybe look at another project later when they're able to absorb more and give it the proper attention that maybe they think it deserves. And keep in mind, I'm just one guy out here doing a bunch of photography. Think of the thousands of people who are attending workshops and readers of Lenswork and all the other magazines who are passionate about, and we're all producing images like crazy. I've said for some time now that one of the problems I recognized early on in my foray into digital photography was the problem of productivity, that in my sheet film days, if I came back from a 4 or 5 day excursion with 48 exposed pieces of sheet film, that was an incredibly successful trip. Now I get 48 images in the first morning of a multi-day trip. I came back from 7 days in Acadia with 800 images. Now, they're not all good ones, of course, but you know what? They're all properly exposed, sharply focused because of the power of digital cameras. And my task is to figure out which ones now make interesting artwork, if any. My last trip to Japan, I came back with 5,000 images. Again, all sharp and properly focused because of the power of the digital camera, all properly exposed. And what do I do with a fire hose of images other than edit, 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 turn them into little projects, and if I'm smart, maybe do so with fewer images than I think? One of the things that I worry about with photography a little bit these days is because of this fire hose of images. I love that phrase, but it just feels so accurate to what's happening to all of us in photography these days. With the fire hose of images that we're not only consuming but producing, that it disempowers the still image because it becomes so common that it's not valuable. Still images aren't treasured anymore, and so we're in a search for how do we make still images special. And the two methodologies that seem to be ruling the roost, at least here in 2024, are to make it really, really big, 42-inch prints and that kind of thing, or to make it really, really saturated, hypercolor that's beyond visible truth. And both of those methods themselves are subject to the idea of becoming a fire hose of images. It is, I think, the conundrum of our time. It's as though we have too much of a good thing, and that too much of a good thing could very easily lead not only us, but the public at large, to a numb response, because suddenly nothing is special, and all of that is coming at us at fire hose volume. And at some point in time, we just hold up our hands to protect our eyes and say, enough. And as a photographer, that does give me some concern. On the other hand, it also means that we need to turn our attention more and more towards the content of what we're communicating, because the image quality is not the determining factor anymore about whether or not something is worthy, but rather the content, the meaning, the connection, the art part is what counts. And as it always has been, that's the most difficult part of making a photograph that anybody will care about.
Copyright 2024, Lenswork Publishing.